beguiled me since I was a boy, perhaps the greatest story in our national history. And that is the armed struggle for independence that we know as the American Revolution. It's a creation story that accounts for who we are, where we came from, what we believe, and what our forebears were willing to die for. As a national saga, it's the stuff of great literature with spectacular characters, variously noble, ignoble, courageous, and tormented, and a plot as improbable as it is spellbinding. I set out to do for the Revolution what I did for the Mediterranean and European theaters in World War II, to write a sweeping narrative, an epic that weaves together tactical combat scenes, marching the reader into battle, with strategic storytelling that illuminates the reasoning and anxieties of those making the decisions that shape both a new nation and Western civilization. My intent is to show war as soldiers and militiamen saw it, terrifying, bestial, and occasionally grand, and as generals fought it, sometimes well, often badly. I also feel that it's important to tell the story from both sides, to see the rebellion as the British saw it and fought it. Much as I adore the musical Hamilton, the hilarious cartoonish character of King George III hardly captures the nuances of a sovereign who presided over the most powerful empire the world had seen since ancient Rome. Toward that end, I spent a lot of research time in Britain, including a month at Windsor Castle, where the papers of America's last king are kept. Most have never been published, and Queen Elizabeth only recently opened them to a small number of scholars, of whom I was among the first. Every day, climb the 102 stone steps and then 21 wooden stairs to the garret of the Round Tower, where I spent countless hours with George, who throughout the Revolution served as his own secretary. His thoughts and commands are written in his hand, and they're revelatory. The book, in fact, opens with young King George as he reviews the Royal Navy fleet in Portsmouth, a scene that I hope you find as vivid and illuminating as I did. The chapters then carry us through the great events of 1775 and 1776. Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, where one out of eight of all the British officers killed during the entire Revolution would die in just 4 hours. Then with the star-crossed American invasion of Canada, the stunning repulse of the Royal Navy at Sullivan's Island outside Charleston, the catastrophic defeat of British and Loyalist forces in Virginia and North Carolina, the long, brutal struggle for control of New York, and the redemptive surprise attack at Trenton on Christmas night, 1776, followed by a second assault at Trenton and then Princeton a week later. We follow the action on battlefields and behind closed doors in Quebec and Boston, Norfolk and Montreal, and in London, Paris, and Cork on the south coast of Ireland, where the British staged their fleets and battalions to wage war across the Atlantic. I spent years trawling through archives, large and small, in search of primary sources, diaries, letters, official and unofficial records, unpublished memoirs, newspaper dispatches. The author Shelby Foote once said that a fact is not a truth until you love it. I believe that my strength as a writer and a historian comes from finding facts to love, teasing coherence and intimacy from the past. I also believe that every page of The British Are Coming contains surprises and revelations. One of the narrative historian's tasks is to harness scholarship and lucid storytelling to bring back the dead, to breathe life into figures who can seem impossibly remote to a 21st century reader. I have the pleasure of living with incredible characters who, for the most part, will be with us for 3 volumes. George Washington, Henry Knox, Benjamin Franklin, Nathaniel Greene, and Benedict Arnold, who incidentally is the finest combat commander on either side in 1776. "I am in the way of duty," Arnold writes after he's badly wounded at Quebec on New Year's Eve, 1775, "and I know no fear." And they're no less compelling on the British side. Not only the king, but his prime minister, Lord North, and the minister who runs the war, Lord Germain, not to mention the Howe brothers, Admiral Richard and General William, and General Henry